The Romans, with their bathhouses, were perhaps the first culture to make personal hygiene a priority. Today, we are positively obsessed with it and with our bathrooms. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we'll trace the evolution of the bathroom from those early Roman bathhouses to today, when many homes have a separate bathroom for every bedroom. I'll talk with Alyssa Whitmore, an anthropologist at the University of Iowa, who has researched the bathhouses of ancient Rome, and we'll explore modern bathrooms with anthropologist Richard Wilk and Penny Coleman, author of Toilets, Bathtubs, Sinks, and Sewers. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. We all have one. Some of us have several. In some homes, the bathroom is strictly utilitarian. In others, it has become a spa-like retreat. This hour, we will trace the evolution of the bathroom from early Roman bathhouses to the bathrooms of today. Later this hour, we'll talk about modern bathrooms and how they got to be this way with anthropologist Richard Wilk and Penny Coleman, author of Toilets, Bathtubs, Sinks, and Sewers. But first, we're going to start with ancient bathrooms. Alyssa Whitmore is working on her PhD in anthropology at the University of Iowa, and she has been researching ancient Roman bathhouses. Hello, Alyssa.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
I think all of us have heard of the Roman bathhouses, but we probably, most of us, don't know very much about them. What was the role of the bathhouse in ancient Roman culture?
So the bathhouse in ancient Roman culture had several roles. You do have the primary role of hygiene, that this is a place where you would go to get clean. For most Romans, especially of the lower classes, you couldn't afford to have a private bath in your own home. So if you ever wanted to actually get into a body of water to bathe, you would have to do this in the public baths. But right up behind that, the public baths had a lot of importance as a social location. People would often spend hours there if they could. The public baths were really quite grand, ranging from size anything towards the first floor of your house to structures as large as football fields. So there are a lot of different rooms that offer a lot of different services. So you could really spend the entire afternoon there. So as a result, it's an important social place as well.
And you mentioned hygiene, and personal hygiene isn't something that a lot of us associate with ancient cultures, but it was important in ancient Rome.
Absolutely. And for them, the idea was mostly dirt. Physical dirt was hygiene for them, so you need to get rid of the dirt. Of course, their hygienic standards would have been far different than ours, but they still had an idea of getting clean and the importance of getting clean.
Well, you mentioned that most people wouldn't have had enough money to have private baths, but some people did have enough money to have private baths, right?
Absolutely. Yes, the upper classes, and including the emperors, could often have some type of bathing facilities within their homes. And especially the upper classes had basically a miniature version of a public bath with several different rooms of varying temperatures and varying temperatures of water as well, so varying pools.
And with the public bathhouses, were men and women separate?
It depends. There seems to have perhaps been change over time, where early on the ancient sources and the architecture of the baths that we found seem to suggest that there were two separate locations for men and women, sometimes completely separate baths, sometimes different sections. But over time, it appears that a lot of men and women were bathing together. We seem to not find anymore in the archaeological record these separate spaces, and a lot of ancient texts then start talking about men and women in the same spaces.
Now, you have been specifically focusing on what can be found in the drains of these ancient bathhouses. Why did you decide to focus on that?
I'm interested in exploring space through the use of material culture, through the things that are found. And in most bathhouses, the artifacts that are found that most likely were owned by people are the ones that end up in drains, because usually you want to take home whatever you brought. So the things that they couldn't take with them are the things that they lost or threw away, and these often end up in the drains.
What have you found in the drains?
A variety of different things. The most The largest assemblages tend to have produced a variety of adornments. So you have ring stones, parts of broken bracelets. So obviously people were wearing different different items of adornment, jewelry, as a way to kind of show off your status as well as personal expression.
And, of course, not all of the people who went to the bathhouses were people of means. So have you found costume jewelry, that kind of thing as well?
Yes, absolutely. A lot of items are made of glass and seem to especially be designed to imitate more expensive counterparts. So knockoff jewelry, basically.
Have you found anything in the jewelry category that has been surprising?
Not a whole lot that's been surprising. Perhaps the quantity of the costume jewelry, what was most surprising. A lot of glass ring stones, a lot of black glass bracelets that seem to be representing or imitating jet. So there seems to be a fair amount of that. A lot of amulets and pendants that would perhaps be intended to protect the bathers while they're in the baths.
Interesting. You've also found medical instruments in the drains. What kind of medical instruments?
Most of the medical instruments that have been found come from a bath in Germany, and the best evidence for a medical instrument is a scalpel, which does suggest that there's some type of surgery going on. Other items that have been found, which perhaps are related to medical practices but could also be used to apply ointments and toilet type thing, so cosmetics, basically.
Okay. Did we know that doctors were practicing in the bathhouses?
There are some suggestions that that could perhaps be the case, but this is really the most solid evidence, are these scalpels that have been found.
Oh, wow. That brings a whole new idea to what it must have been like to be there. Do you think that there was you mentioned that most of these instruments have been found in one location. Would there have been a bathhouse that would have been dedicated to medical needs, do you think?
Probably not an entire bathhouse. The reason that we think that medicine perhaps could be practiced here is because a lot of the baths would have a good source of running water, whereas perhaps in some communities that would be the best place. But we do think there are some perhaps basically hospitals that may have existed. So it may not be necessarily common to have medicine and surgeries in every bath. So these may be kind of unique circumstances.
You have also found food waste in the drains.
Yeah, absolutely. So we know from ancient texts that people are eating and drinking in the baths, but most of the times it's talked about as kind of finger foods and this type of things, cakes and sweets that wouldn't preserve well in the archaeological record. But we do have a variety of cups, plates, fragments that end up in the drains, as well as one particular drain, several actually, have produced bones of animals, actually. And in some cases, preserved stones from olives, seeds from poppy seeds that were probably from bread. So that's kind of more strong evidence for the variety of foods that are being eaten.
It also calls into question the cleanliness of the water, I would think.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Have there been any other surprises, any other things that you found in the drains?
Yes, I have found in several different baths needles and spindle whorls, and so the type of items that perhaps suggest that cloth working was taking place in the baths, which sounds perhaps a little bit odd for a wet environment, but there would be so many spaces within the baths that wouldn't necessarily have water, that wouldn't necessarily be hot. So people do seem to have perhaps taken some of their work to the baths with them.
Are these items being uncovered from drains now, or is this something that has been taken out of drains in the past and preserved?
So these have been taken out of drains in the past. Most of my research is primarily archival. So I've been going through published and unpublished reports from previous excavations.
And what do you think that you've really been able to take away from all of this research and putting these items together in a new way?
Just the variety of different activities that are taking place. I think a lot of times we start to think about spaces as having specific functions that only certain types of activities are performed there. But really, a lot of places, especially in the ancient world, but also in the modern world, are multifunctional. We're doing a variety of different things. People are using spaces in different ways.
Do you have more questions that you're hoping to answer?
Yes, absolutely. I'd like to start expanding my sample and looking at baths from different areas of the Roman Empire, different time periods, to start to see if the artifacts can suggest changes in bathing culture over time. So, for example, we talked about how, well, it does seem that perhaps men and women bathe separately and then together. Well, what other changes in bathing activities can we actually see reflected in the archaeological record?
In just a couple of minutes, we're going to talk about how we went from the Roman bathhouses through history to where we are today. And there's a major disconnect there. The Romans considered personal hygiene to be very important. But in the Renaissance, for example, personal hygiene was not a high priority among people. So there is a disconnect between these bathhouses and today. But do you see things about our modern bathrooms that you think are connected to that past?
Absolutely. I see it more in spas and in YMCAs than I do see in our own personal bathrooms. But these public spaces that we have where a variety of activities take place, but also hygiene is important. In some cases, relaxation is important. So I see it especially in those locations.
Well, and it's interesting you say spas and YMCAs. Would you think that would be the sort of the difference between the upper class bathhouses and the middle class bathhouses?
Not necessarily. I would see especially even the upper classes going to public baths is what we see in ancient texts. So they're going there for the social aspect as well. So I imagine it would be just as loud and noisy there as it would be in any public bath. Perhaps maybe less so, but it would still have a very strong social feel in a perhaps more upper class public bath.
What do you think would surprise most people about those Roman bathhouses?
The size, really, I think, is one of the things. And also just the different culture. And
why would the size surprise us?
Well, we think of bathrooms as this very usually small room. But really, these are large sets of rooms and rooms that can be very, very large. I mean, even the size of an entire first floor of a house, that can be one single room. So there would be a lot of people there. So that's another difference, that it would be completely normal to bathe in public. And a lot of their public toilets even have people side by side. So it's a very different idea of modesty and what public really is.
Alyssa, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Alyssa Whitmore is a PhD candidate in anthropology at the University of Iowa. She's been researching ancient Roman bathhouses, and we're going to continue to talk about bathrooms this hour on Talk of Iowa. We're going to talk about the evolution from those ancient Roman bathhouses to today's bathrooms. This is Talk of Iowa.
Well, here I am in my tubby again, and my tubby's all filled with water and nice fluffy suds. And I've got my soap and washcloth to wash myself. And I've got my nifty scrub brush to help me scrub my back. And I've got a big fluffy towel to dry myself when I'm done. But there's one other thing that makes tubby time the very best time of the whole day. And do you know what that is? It's a very special friend of mine, my very favorite little pal. Oh, rubber ducky, you're the one. You make bath time lots of fun. Rubber ducky, I'm awfully fond of you. Bo, bo, bo-dee-o, rubber ducky.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about bathrooms, and we're going to find out now how bathrooms evolved into what we know today. The current trend in bathroom design is to create luxurious spa-like rooms where homeowners can retreat from the world. This bathroom boom is about fantasy and the power of imagination, as well as harmonizing our self-image with the outside world. Before we dive into how these ultra-luxurious water closets came to be and what they say about us, we'll stop in at Studio H2O. It's a showroom of the Plumber Supply Company in Iowa City. We wanted to get a sense of what Iowans want from their bathrooms and what a bathroom sanctuary would look like to them. Okay, maybe we won't go to that right now. We'll hear those voices in a little while. But with me now is Richard Wilk. He is provost and professor of anthropology at Indiana University in Bloomington. Hello, Richard. Oh, he's also not here yet. Okay. I'm learning all kinds of exciting things. Is Penny Coleman on the line? She's author of Toilets. Great. Hi, Penny.
Yeah, author of Toilets, Bathtub, Sinks, and Sewers, A History of the Bathroom. I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, thank you so much for being here with me today, Penny. And when I was talking to my last guest about those ancient Roman bathhouses, we were talking about the fact that there is a disconnect between the bathhouses of ancient Rome and how much Romans cared about personal hygiene and the years that followed, because hygiene became a lot less important. And I think when we think about, let's say, British culture, European culture, before a lot of people came to the United States, we think about chamber pots and basins. And then when the United States was settled, maybe we think about outhouses. So why do you think there was this disconnect between the Roman culture of bathing and what came after?
Well, I think that the fate of the Roman Empire had something to do with it, in the fact of it being overrun by the warring tribes from northern, western, and eastern Europe that overran them, which, of course, as all of us probably remember from our school days, that they were called the barbarians, who overran them and lived in more primitive ways. And they had not built the great cities and highways like the Romans, and they weren't people who were involved in lots of reading and writing, and their habit was more to destroy buildings and certainly the aqueducts and the public baths. And so there was a dramatic decline in the standard of living, and also dramatic difference in terms of the value, as your last guest was talking about, of the Roman baths, of the sociability, this notion of this was a place where people could go and be very social. And then with the Christianity, this new religion that begins to rise and to spread, had very different attitudes about cleanliness. Many early Christian leaders thought cleanliness had nothing to do with religion and certainly nothing to do with being social. And in fact, for many, bathing was considered sinful. So this change of attitude, which developed during this period, also the legacy of the public baths having degenerated into places of sex orgies and unruly parties. I mean, all of these kinds of the legacy and the attitudes affected, of course, how people viewed bathing. Saint Benedict, who was an early religious leader, actually wrote, "To those who are well, and especially the young, bathing shall seldom be permitted." Saint Francis of Assisi considered dirtiness a sign of the holy person, and Saint Catherine of Siena avoided washing at all. I mean, there's just this whole legacy. We can go on to Queen Isabella, who, as we again remember, funded Christopher Columbus, prided herself on only taking two baths. So there's a shift in the use of the Roman bath. There's a shift in the attitudes and the assumptions that come about for a variety of complex historic reasons.
As I mentioned, when the United States was settled, I guess we think quite a bit of outhouses, digging a hole in the ground and building a wooden structure over that so that you can dispose of waste in that way. In cities in the United States, how was waste handled in the early years of settlement?
Well, interesting, when I was writing my book and I got to the dealing with the United States, it's, one of the great things about being a writer is all the things that I learn. And I ended up titling my chapter Lots of Pigs, because one of the ways in cities that certainly up into the 1830s was pigs roamed the streets, and people would dispose of their garbage and their waste by oftentimes throwing it in the street. And Cincinnati, in fact, got the name of Porkopolis because there were so many pigs roaming the streets. Charles Dickens writes about that when he comes to the United States. So that was one of the ways. There were also, you know, what you mentioned, the chamber pots. There were also a type of a latrine would be built. Sometimes it would overhang out of a building that would drop into wood ash. They were called like dry toilets. But there was no sense of the public health threat of all of this behavior, and there was a real reluctance. If, in fact, any far-thinking city officials thought about building a sewage system, people would refuse, you know, to take on the high taxes, would refuse to take on the cost, because, again, there wasn't this understanding of what this meant for public health.
Well, the first city with a modern sewer system was Chicago, and they built their sewers in the mid-1980s, or not 1980s, I'm sorry, 1880s. That's a very different time. In the mid-1880s, what prompted Chicago to take such a big step?
Well, some historians, of course, will say that, yes, Chicago does get credited with having the first comprehensive sewage project, but that, in fact, New York City had provided a general model for the development of the water supply in terms of, you know, actually thinking of ways to bring water into the city, and also setting up privy stations, you know, cleanups. And as early as the 1700s in New York, officials had prohibited scavengers from dumping what they called tubs of filth. There's also a move in New York of a civic-minded women who really takes a lead, and I think that's also true in Chicago, that women are becoming more sort of politically aware. You know, this is the whole period of the fight for women's rights and for suffrage, so this is when the temperance movement is in full-fledged, and this becomes a way of dealing with sanitation issues. This becomes a venue where women can take the lead to clean up their city, to do domestic housekeeping. In New Orleans at about this same time, two women actually form a league, the Gordon Sisters, and they form a league of Women's League for Sewage and Drainage. And at that time, the women in New Orleans could vote if they paid taxes. So these the Gordon Sisters got a petition and to force a special election in which taxpayers could vote to build a new sanitation system. I mean, money, one of the things, as with many things, is you sort of have to trace the money in terms of people's resistance and officials' resistance to building sanitation. And it's also true in Chicago. But with there's a force of like-minded people who can figure out a way, like the Gordon Sisters, so they hold the special election, and the new sanitation system is overwhelmingly approved by female and male taxpayers. And actually, a plaque was erected to this organization that they got through the vote of taxpaying women, helped secure the great public necessities of water, sewage, and drainage. And that plaque for years was on the sewage and water building in New Orleans, and now it's in a vault. But that's a thing to kind of look at within any of these cities, in New York, in Chicago, in New Orleans, in Philadelphia, is the role of women and their emergence in terms of being involved in public health issues and finding ways to pressure and to lobby and to promote proper sanitation.
Now, outside of the cities, of course, the outhouses were working pretty well for a long time. When did it start to become common for people to have toilets in their homes?
Yeah, I actually was going to say but there was a very long period before even the outhouses in some rural areas where people were also just digging a hole in the ground. I mean, the bathroom habits of the, you know, during the American history, really up until the mid 1800s, is very primitive. Now, true, there were certainly bathtubs, and there were outhouses in rural areas, you know, sporadically. Certainly in the 1700s, you know, we begin to see the emergence of this, but it's very sort of hit or miss in terms of that. And again, with the emergence of more, like the first hotel, the Tremont Hotel, that has, you know, public baths running indoor plumbing, is as early as 1829 in Boston, and then 5 years later, another a Tremont is built in New York City. So, but it's very spotty. Then there's one in Buffalo that emerges, and it's really not, if we think of it as a widespread phenomenon, certainly based on my research, it's really post-World War I where it becomes, where indoor bathrooms and indoor toilets becomes something that is available more available to more in more American homes.
I'm talking with Penny Coleman. She's author of Toilets, Bathtubs, Sinks, and Sewers. And with us also is Richard Wilk. He's provost and professor of anthropology at Indiana University in Bloomington. Hello, Richard.
Good morning. I'm learning a great deal listening to Penny.
Oh, good. The idea of personal cleanliness is one that, of course, is incredibly important in the United States today, but that's something that reaches pretty far back in U.S. culture, doesn't it, Richard?
Well, I think cleanliness as an aesthetic is very different from the kind of intensity with which today we kind of look at ourselves in the mirror and scrub every pore and are deeply, deeply concerned about our breath and our teeth and our feet and every other part of our body. I think a lot of that is a much more recent development that comes partially out of advertising and a kind of general consumer culture that focuses attention on our own bodies.
But the U.S., was it the first country to make it a common idea to bathe every day?
Well, I lived in London in the 1960s, and as a schoolboy, I can remember just how kind of horrifying the stench of unwashed bodies was on the tube, the subway, and on buses. And I think historically, the habit of daily washing didn't really get embedded in England until the 1980s and 90s, the Thatcher era.
Yeah, and I can just jump in here. It's important to, when you talk about this habit of daily bathroom, to remember just how difficult it was to take a bath, to get, you know, the hot water. This is not something that was a very easy thing. It's like, I took a shower this morning, and what did I do? I jump in the shower and I turn on two faucets. So this was not an easy thing to do. And there's also a really important element, which is the role, and I know Richard's done so much wonderful work on consumer culture, the role of the plumbing industry in terms of its campaign. Some scholars of public relations think that the plumbing industry's campaign in 1920 to promote bathing, bathtubs, and bathrooms with their booklet that they published called The Story of the Bath, that they distributed hundreds of thousands of copies. I remember being open-eyed when I discovered a copy of this booklet that was distributed to schools and institutions, and it was widely read. And this is the same time where the United States has also gone through the influenza epidemic, which is, has killed hundreds of thousands of people and totally traumatized the country. But here's if I can just take a moment to read just a quote from this widely read pamphlet that really sold innumerable, according to the industry, innumerable bathrooms and fixtures, and really inculcated this notion of the importance of daily bathing by saying, less than 40 years ago, which of course is 1880, yellow fever and smallpox were frequent callers, and before that, cholera boldly strode the highways and byways, counting its victims. Plague spots dotted our landscape. Now all of that has changed, and what did it? Pure water piped into the home, poisonous gases piped out of the home. Bathing! Exclamation point. So, you know, whether there's that's cause and effect, there is a dramatic increase in the number of bathrooms being built and bathtubs and sinks being sold.
Well, we're going to take a short break here. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Penny Coleman, author of Toilets, Bathtubs, Sinks, and Sewers, and Richard Wilk, provost and professor of anthropology at Indiana University in Bloomington. And let's listen to the voices of some Iowans who were at Studio H2O this weekend at the Plumber Supply Company in Iowa City, talking about what a bathroom should look like to them.
You know, we're such a society of instant and hurry and rush, and we're finding out that people are wanting to put more money into making their bathroom like another room, not just a bathroom, but they're putting in furniture pieces. They're trying to make it much more of a relaxing area, sanctuary.
A dream bathroom for me would just be a large enough footprint or floor space that I can walk through it and not feel like I'm walking sideways through between my countertop and my toilet or something.
Generally, the consumer is looking for, they want something that will take what's happened to their body and change it. So any way they can rejuvenate, replenish, refresh is important.
Also, color is so important. You need to have color that invigorates you or relaxes you or just makes you feel good.
If I could afford it, if money wasn't an issue, I would spend on a bubble bath or some kind of whirlpool in there. I would put a nice big shower just to stand and relax in.
I love my shower curtain. It's got seashells on it because I like to go to the beach, and I know it's kind of hokey, but it's a nice warm place and place to think about when you're in Iowa.
The voices of Ann Oglesby, owner Jim Ballmer, and Patty Stutzman, Honor Clark, also from Studio H2O in Iowa City. We'll continue talking about bathrooms in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
Scanning through the bathroom window.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about bathrooms, and we've been finding out how bathrooms evolved from the chamber pot and basin and the outhouse to today, when many houses have a bathroom for every single bedroom, when people want their bathrooms to be some sort of a spa-like retreat instead of just a very utilitarian room. We'll get back to our guests in just a moment, but let's hear the voices of some more Iowans. Bathrooms are private rooms, but a lot of us care very much about what others think about them. Let's go back now to Studio H2O in Iowa City to hear how social pressures motivate us in bathroom design.
It's pretty much stuff from the 70s, so it was all peachy and not very updated, not very, good looks or anything like that. So we just decided we're going to start ripping it out and put some new stuff in.
Yeah, it's pretty embarrassing when we have people come over. I don't want anyone to go in there, so it needs replacing.
I think most people, when they come in, are looking to make a bathroom that's more vibrant in a way, and so they're looking for things that... And it kind of depends on whether the bathroom is going to be seen by their friends or neighbors or just for their personal use. It's going to be seen by a friend. They like something that makes a statement. So they're going to look a lot of time for something that's unique.
Now, the one that we have here in the showroom, you've got the chromotherapy. You've got the sound piped in so you can, hook up your MP3 player. It was roughly list price $12,000. So he orders two. Gets it installed. And actually had the plumber, he put them up in a hotel so that he could get this project done before Thanksgiving, before all his guests came.
Resale. Someday I'm moving south.
The voices we heard belong to Vincent and Karen Bowles, owner Jim Balmer, Ann Oglesby, Patty Stutzman, and Cheryl Lee. Again, that's Studio H2O in Iowa City. And this hour, we are talking about bathrooms. We want to hear from you as well. What's important to you in your bathroom? Have you spent quite a bit of money to redesign your bathroom? What motivated you? What do you love about it now? Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me is Richard Wilk, Provost and Professor of Anthropology at Indiana University in Bloomington, and Penny Coleman, author of Toilets, Bathtubs, Sinks, and Sewers. And Richard, just before the break, Penny was talking about how in the 1920s, marketing firms sold us on the idea of cleanliness and personal hygiene and bathrooms in the United States. How did that change our homes?
Oh, it changed our homes in a lot of different ways. Before that, of course, you know, there might be one place in the house where there was well water or other piped water available, and the idea of having water piped around the house or hot water was really quite unthinkable. People often used just a wash basin and a pitcher to hold the water next to it, wash their faces and maybe their hands several times a day. So notion of daily bathing and this kind of intense consciousness and embarrassment about your own body started. Houses have to be converted at great expense, and plumbing has to be installed. And then think about something else we have in our bathrooms these days, which is storage for the immense number of personal cleanliness and hygiene products that most of us own. Almost all of which were invented in the 20th century, along with a lot of the diseases that we are familiar with, like halitosis, which was first identified by toothpaste manufacturers in the early part of the 20th century, but rapidly gets medicalized. And as Penny was saying, this notion that cleanliness and personal grooming are necessary for your health turned out to be an extremely powerful way of transforming people's sense of their body and at the same time pouring immense amounts of money into putting clean potable water into every house in America. And we kind of forget how many billions, or actually some estimates say trillions of dollars, have gone into water and sewage systems in this country, retrofitting enormous numbers of houses in the early part of the 20th century.
Well, certainly. And you mentioned the difference between being in Britain in the 1960s and the United States at that time. And when you visit Europe now, bathrooms are much smaller and water heaters are different than our water heaters here. And a lot of places that you stay, you still share a bathroom with other people who are staying in a bed and breakfast or that kind of thing. Is it because we're such a new country? Do you think that we were able to have this boom of bathrooms?
Well, it's definitely true that the pace of house construction in this country in the 20th century has been unlike anywhere else in the world. And in Europe, many people were already in relatively small quarters. So adding a full kitchen and a full bathroom, or even two, turned out to crowd a lot of the other rooms, and there wasn't a lot of room for expansion. Whereas here in the United States, we have plenty of room, and the construction of new houses with lots of bathrooms goes along with the sprawl and the construction of new suburbs and entire new towns. All of this at tremendous environmental cost and tremendous, but also for led to tremendous profits for not just the bathroom industry, but the construction industry and the real estate industry as well.
Patty, why do you think we bought into the prevalence of bathrooms and private bathrooms?
Well, clearly the role of our hyper consumer culture. I mean, we're just besieged. I mean, we're under attack, I would have to say, with advertisement, with this massive corporate consumer culture in America, I think unrivaled, certainly in parts of the world that I'm familiar with, all designed to get us to buy things to make us, you know, tied to our identity, tied to our sense of success, tied to, you know, other people's opinions of us, tied to whether we're going to be healthy or not healthy. I mean, just think in the last few years, I think probably I would date it to the scare about SARS when now there are all these hand sanitizers, you know, where people are sanitizing, they're spritzing, they're spraying. And it's like one more product after another product. Go into a grocery store. There's so many brands of toothpaste. I mean, Richard talked about the invention of halitosis as a disease, and mouthwashes and toilet papers. I needed to buy toilet paper yesterday, and I just was overwhelmed. I had to think, okay, do I want this? Do I want that? Da 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 da. And I just kept saying to myself, simple, Penny. All you want is something simple that's not going to, you know, be perfumed or colored or be bad for the environment. So I think that I don't want to say that Americans are any more gullible than anybody else in the world, but it is always astonishing to me to see the emergence. And the emergence in the last 5 or 6 years maybe of makeup for men. It's really quite an amazing phenomenon to watch. I look at the difference from my granddaughter was born in 2003, and I look at the difference in what, you know, the wipes and the diapers when Sophie was born in 2003, and now what's out there in the markets with my partner's grandchildren who are being born, and it's another huge market around.
Yes, we even have deodorant for children now.
Exactly, and that's since 2003, and I stand there and I say, is everybody just gullible? I mean, do we really need all of this? And I think of when my children were born, I had three basically in 2 years, and, you know, I'd put diapers in my pockets and that would be it. You know, if I couldn't carry it on my body with these three little kids, then I wouldn't take it. And now it's like you need a quartermaster to marshal all the stuff that's being sold to young parents.
We're talking this hour about bathrooms in the United States and bathrooms in Iowa and how we've evolved to where we are today. You're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Karen is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Karen.
Hello.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, I just want to make a comment on consumer culture and what, quote, everybody, unquote, has to have. And my husband and I built a house in the 80s. We put in the jacuzzi and the master bath because the builder said, quote, unquote, everybody wants one, and we needed it for resale. So we sold that house in the early 2000s and moved into a condo that was already built and had a huge jacuzzi in it with a deck and the whole 9 yards, and for 11 years we've lived with it sitting there doing nothing. Not a drop of water ever went into that jacuzzi. And so finally we've just spent way a lot of money to get it taken out and to have not only the bathroom revised, but on the outer wall in the hall we got a huge closet and something that we find totally usable space instead of having a tub just sitting there. So it just emphasizes to me what, quote-unquote, everybody has to have isn't necessarily the case.
Oh, Karen, thank you so much for your call. And that is very interesting because we are dedicating a lot of space to bathrooms, and jacuzzis were huge in the 1980s. But, you know, people are still remodeling their homes to create more space for bathrooms. And Richard, one of the important things that you think is in the bathroom is the mirror. That's a very important part of why we spend so much time there, right?
Yeah, I think we've seen a proliferation where mirrors are occupying large areas of the bathroom. And I think it's interesting that at the same time, mirrors are more or less disappearing from the public parts of the house. But the amount of time that people spend in front of mirrors, I don't think any social scientists or historians have measured it. But I think this intensive surveillance of ourselves and comes out of a lot of insecurity in a rapidly changing society about who we are and what we look like. Thorstein Veblen, a great economist, argued long ago that what makes Americans different from Europeans is that for Americans, identity is a do-it-yourself project. We're not judged as much in this country by who our parents were or how, you know, where we were born. We're judged largely instead by the way we behave and how we look. And in this do-it-yourself project, we have to be thinking about, you know, do we have crow's feet? What part of our body needs work? How are we going to lose weight or maintain our proper weight or gain weight? And as Penny said, the marketers have played this to the point where they're not just depending on old invented diseases like halitosis, but I think in the last couple of years we've actually got a disease where of thinning eyebrows, or is it eyelashes? I think it's right. Thinning eyelashes. Uh-huh. That require a prescription medication that has lots of side effects.
Well, and Penny,
in terms of the mirror, I love your conversation about the mirror. And there's a company in Japan called Toto. It's a company that's been innovating. I guess in the 80s, it produced a toilet that would release warm air to dry you after you use the toilet. And they now have just put a toilet on the market that when you sit on the toilet, you can get your blood pressure and all kinds of urine analysis. So, but their latest thing, and I don't think it's on the market yet, but that you can find it on their website, is a mirror that you can adjust to give you different looks in terms of the kind of makeup. So it's a computerized mirror that when you look at it, you can tell it what image you want, and it can tell you what makeup to apply to achieve that.
Well,
wow.
Penny, one of the things that you mentioned as well, and this is related to an email from Maureen in Iowa City. She says, when remodeling a bathroom, be sure it's handicapped accessible.
I
developed a disability, and the plumbing remodel company that I use designed and installed a barrier-free shower and a wide enough area within the bathroom to accommodate a lift. Very important for an aging population. And that's very true. But you also point out that the way that bathrooms are accessible, accessibility to bathrooms, is also a measure of somebody's power and status. And handicapped bathrooms were not commonly available for a long time, and especially portable bathrooms, porta potties, were not handicapped accessible for a long time.
Yes, exactly. And that's, again, the link. And it's one of the things that Richard's been talking about, is the link to our identity. And it's about power and status. It's, you know, it's what your caller talked about in terms of, you know, what people think, because everybody has it. And we're a culture that does not want to deal with and think about disability, our own or anybody else's. And so it takes, you know, federal legislation and fierce advocates, you know, public advocates, again, citizens who, you know, force manufacturers and builders to make bathrooms handicap accessible. It's just been, again, within the last few years that now porta potties, I've just noticed maybe within the last 3 or 4 years that porta potties are now available at public events that are handicapped accessible, wide enough for a wheelchair.
Right. We are out of time. Penny Coleman, thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Penny Coleman is the author of Toilets, Bathtubs, Sinks, and Sewers, and Richard Wilk, professor of anthropology at Indiana University in Bloomington. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you very much. I'm going to run out and buy Penny's book.
All right. Thanks a lot for your time today. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Sarah Bowden, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support from John Pemble. Today, podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. Talk of Iowa is a production of IPR News.
Splish, splash, I was taking a bath long about a Saturday night. Just relaxing in the tub, thinking everything was all right. Well, I stepped out the tub, put my feet on the floor. I wrapped the towel around me and I opened the door. And in a splish splash in the bath, well, I was out of nowhere, what are you going?